everybody. My name's Elaine, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Billy, for inviting me to come out here tonight. It's always a privilege to be asked to speak to any group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is May 11th of 2000. I do have a home group, and I have a sponsor. And I mention that because I think sponsors are pretty important. I've gone without them sometimes. I have picked ones that maybe didn't click with me. I learned that after the fact. I've probably had 7 sponsors. 2 of them moved away. 2 times I moved away. But I can tell you that the sponsor that made the greatest impact in my life came into my life when I had 10 years. And I'll talk about that a little more when I talk about what happened. But just to qualify a little bit, I started drinking when I was about 12 years old. I grew up in a really unique family. My parents adopted 14 children from all over the world. I was the only biological. And it was, to compare it to Lord of the Flies really would not be a stretch. I mean, it really wouldn't be. And there were some crazy times and there were some awesome times, like with any family. Neither one of my parents drank, but they traveled internationally and they would bring back their little bottles that they used to give on airplanes, and they kept them in their bathroom drawer, and I knew where they were. And all the kids would play games out in the, we lived in a cul-de-sac, and I mean, I'm sure people are familiar with Kick the Can and all that stuff. And my mom would literally in the summer say, get out of here, I'll see you at dinner time. It was a very different time than most people in this room probably, that was their experience too. But we would play these games and it was so much fun. And, you know, we would take liquor from our parents' thing and, you know, drink liquor. And first time I got drunk, it was off of scotch. And I hated how it tasted, but I loved how it made me feel. You know, I don't think my story is unique. I loved that it made me really more fun than I thought I was. I loved that I felt like I not only fit in, but was a leader more than I really was. And, you know, we just had a really fun time, actually. And, you know, I can say that most of my drinking, I had a pretty fun time. I made really bad choices sometimes, but, you know, I went through, I was an athlete all every season. I started working when I was 14. I always wanted, you know, when you have that many kids, there's not a lot of disposable income for, you know, expensive things. And so I think I probably got it from my grandmother, but I always had a really high standard for quality. When I started drinking, I drank Tanqueray while everyone else was drinking Bud Light or whatever. And I had to have my lime, and I really enjoyed it, and I could tell the difference between cheap gin and good gin. I could. And so, you know, my point is just that I was really busy, very active, you know, had a lot of friends. I really can't say that many bad things about my childhood in some aspects. But my mom was never there. My dad worked all the time to support us. We had a nanny, but it wasn't a Mary Poppins nanny. It was a woman that my mom rescued off the streets of New Delhi, India. And to this day, I do not eat curry because we had it every night. You know, I went to a small all-girls school in Frederick, Maryland. In 1988, my family had a tragedy. Our house burned down and my 2 little brothers were killed. And that's really when my drinking kicked in. I wanted to numb myself however I could. Drugs are also part of my story, but they were not my drug of choice by any means. And I only did them when I was drunk. I didn't really believe in God after that happened. I'm Jewish, but my mother converted our family to being Mormon when I was 8. So I was raised Mormon. I would bring coffee to seminary every morning. Mormons don't drink coffee. And I hated every minute of it, and I rebelled. And, you know, growing older, it's kind of funny when I think back over my life, and it's really started to happen now. I'm 44. I really actually appreciate how I was raised, because I have really great values that were instilled in me. You know, my father always told me, work hard and do the right thing. Just do the right thing. Treat people the way you'd want to be treated. Treat everybody the same. And, you know, we are all the same. I mean, I didn't see color. There was no racism in my world. I didn't even know what that was. You know, so many pieces I feel really, really grateful for. And I'm resilient. I mean, super resilient. But, you know, during that time, it was really, really hard. And my family was really unique. I mean, that wasn't really happening a lot in the 80s. You know, parents adopting it. You know, it was before Angelina Jolie. It was, but you know, I mean, my mom was one of the, she was kind of a pioneer with in the world of adoption. And our family was all over the news in the Baltimore Sun. And the reality was my younger brother, who was adopted from me, orphanage in Korea, that was, he had cerebral palsy, and in that culture, if anything's wrong with you, you get put away. And so he had a lot of issues, and he was trying to kill himself and set the house on fire. So there were two trials. One was to decide if he was going to be tried as an adult or a juvenile, and the second was, what do we do with him now? So our family was, you know, and then there was, you know, well, he was abused when he was younger in the orphanage. But you know what happened. It turned into the kids abused their children. I mean, it was crazy, you know, especially for my younger siblings that were still in school. And I had a really, really hard time for about 3 years. My parents handled it very different ways. My dad completely went into work. We never saw him. And my mother, you know, had affairs. And I just got really, really busy. I dropped out of school without even telling my parents. So I dropped out for a semester, and then I moved back home. You know, my parents bought another home. I moved back home for a semester because I didn't want to be far away at all. And then I, you know, transferred to Maryland, and that's where I graduated from. But during that period also, I was bartending, and I waited tables all through, you know, since I was 16. I mean, I was a bus girl when I was 14. I couldn't wait to be a waitress, and then I couldn't wait to be a bartender. And that business is a lot of fun, and you can make a lot of money, but it's also, you know, most people drink in that business. And I worked at a bar in Columbia, Maryland, that was very, very popular. There was a line out the door to get in. It was an expensive bar, so the, you know, clientele was pretty high end, and I was the only female bartender, and I was 23 and had long blonde hair and thought I just was the hottest thing in the world. And when you're a bartender, no matter what you think or what they think, they want to be your friend. So I got a lot of attention, and so my ego was so big, it was ridiculous. You know, I just thought that I was making $1,000 a week working three nights a week. I mean, it was, you know, and I bought my own car. I moved out on my own. I moved out on my own because I got kicked out when I was 19 or 20 because I was drunk and had friends over, and my mother and I got in a big fight, and I got kicked out. And I was like, fine, see you later. And I was on my own. And, you know, so at any rate, you know, that's when my drinking really kicked in. So that went on until I was about 25. I ended up getting a job. And, you know, what I really wanted was to make a lot of money and have a big title. That was my goal. And so I did whatever it took to, I became a workaholic. And I was a female in financial services, which means that if you're relatively intelligent and look a certain way, you can move up pretty quickly because they need females in that industry. And so I was a VP on Wall Street by the time I was 28. And I am not saying this to make myself sound self-important, but it fed into my disease. had a car pick me up on Monday. I flew to three cities every week. I had an expense account. I could do whatever I wanted. I could buy people dinner at, like, high-end steakhouses. And I just thought that I was pretty hot shit. I mean, so, like, my whole 20s, I thought that, you know, I thought that I wasn't supposed to cuss. I'm sorry. I apologize. In my little prayer, help me say something, that, and please help me not to cuss. I said it. So at any rate, I, you know, when I was 29, I had moved back to Washington, and I, you know, did a, Craigslist didn't exist then, but I found a roommate through some other thing, and we lived in DuPont Circle in a brownstone, and, you know, it was a beautiful home, and my roommate was a guy named John D., and he still to this day is like a big brother to me, and he was in AA. And I had always wondered if I had a problem, but the people I hung out with, their life was so much like mine. It's not a big deal if you throw up all over yourself on your way home. I mean, seriously, I didn't think that was weird. Or if I blacked out, everybody does, you know? Fortunately, I didn't have, like, any severe thing happen to me. I never got, you know, raped. I never got a DUI. I never, you know, ended up in a bad neighborhood in D.C. I mean, I was pretty lucky. But there were many mornings I didn't know where my car was. And I did get pulled over a couple times and was able to get out of it. I knew it was only a matter of time. I mean, I was smart enough to know that. But I was living with John, and a few things happened. One night I went out with a guy, and we went back to his house, and he wouldn't let me leave, and I called John crying, and I was drunk, and I called John crying and said, can you come get me? And he did. And we talked about it the next day, and oh gosh, I shouldn't have drunk that much. It was just weird. I was so scared. Thank you for coming and getting me. Nothing happened. I was fine. And then one night I came home, and I was so wasted. And I can remember the night because we were at Sign of the Whale. Anybody knows, you know, I think it's M Street. And it's this dive bar that's packed. And I was like, I'm only going to have – and there was something going on, like a big sports event or a presidential debate or something that, like, you go to a bar and you want to watch it. And I was thinking to myself, I'm just going to have, like, one or two beers. And I had my second beer, and I was walking out, and people that I used to work with at Clyde's in Georgetown came in. And it was like, oh, my God, how you doing? Sure, I'll sit down and have a glass of wine with you. You want to do a shot of Grand Marnier? Absolutely, let's do that. And that turned into probably six glasses of wine and four shots of Grand Marnier. And I don't even know how I got home, but I walked up the stairs and then fell down the stairs. And then my purse went everywhere. And then I went out on the back porch to have a cigarette, left the back porch open all night in DuPont Circle, and then passed out in my bed with my clothes on. I mean, you know, I was just a mess. And the next morning I came downstairs because we had like a, you know, you walked up to get in the living room and then walked up to go to the bathroom or go to the bedrooms. And I came downstairs, and I was so hungover. And I had gained a lot of weight, by the way, too. I mean, I was kind of, this is my normal weight. I was about 20 pounds more than I was. And I didn't really like how I looked. And I just felt like I kind of didn't care. I was starting to have, like, wet brain. I couldn't find my words a lot of times. I would forget things. My stomach was always a mess. I just looked bad. And I wore really nice clothes and drove what I thought was a very nice car, but I looked horrible. I looked like dead inside. And I wasn't eating well. I mean, you know those nights when you're drinking and I go get a foot long at 2 in the morning. It's disgusting, right? And so the next day I came downstairs and John was sitting at the table with a cup of coffee. And I was like, he goes, you know, I don't know what he said, like rough night last night or good night last night or something, you know? And I was like, oh my God, it was crazy, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, Elaine, I really, here's a cup of coffee. I need to talk to you. And I was like, what's up? And he said, I can't remember exactly what he said, but basically he said, I can't live like this. And I'm not going to tell you that you have a drinking problem, but I will tell you that I can't live like this. So you can either stop drinking or you need to find another place to live. And I was like, got on the phone with my best friend and said, I have to find another place to live. And I did use different language because I wasn't happy. But that was where I went. It wasn't like, oh, maybe I should look at this. Now, this is how God works, and I think this is just so funny, actually. So the person that I called was someone that I loved, loved, loved going out and drinking with, and she could drink just as much as me. And if anybody knows D.C., we used to go to the back bar of the Old Ebbett Grill and just suck down Chardonnay. And I worked for Clyde's Restaurant Group, and they owned the Ebbett, so I got hooked up. You know, I barely had a check. I was like, or leave a bartender $20 and whatever. I mean, it was so simple. And I hadn't seen her in a while, you know, but I called her because I think I thought she'll get this. She'll help me move. And she said, have you even wondered where I've been for the past couple months? And I was like, actually, yeah, I haven't seen you. What's going on? I mean, I was so self-involved, it was ridiculous. I mean, I didn't have time to think about anybody but me. And she said, I have been going to, I can't remember what it's called right now, but it's a very popular outpatient program in D.C. And I'm trying to get sober. And it was the same exact, I can't tell you have a drinking problem, but you may want to look at it, and I'm going to a meeting tonight if you want to come. And I went to that meeting that night. It was the P Street meeting. It was on P Street in D.C., and it was called the Phoenix meeting. And I saw three people that I knew. Because in my mind, alcoholics was always, you know, I wouldn't fit in. It was old men that probably wore raincoats and, you know, drank really cheap Thunderbird or something. I mean, I didn't think there would be, I mean, it sounds silly now, right? Because we all know how it is. But I didn't think there would be women there, and I didn't think there would be any women that, you know, would look like me or, you know, sound like me or that I would know or that I had worked with before. And so that was my first meeting, and I've never gone back out since that meeting. And I kept hearing stories, and I related real quick. I know that's not everybody's story, but I was really, really lucky. I lived in, you know, Washington, D.C. There were a lot of people my age. We all hung out together. We'd go to the Friday night, you know, beginners meeting, and then go up at 7, and then we'd go to the St. Albans meeting at 8:30, and then we'd all go out to eat. And there was, like, you know, probably like 10 to 15 of us. And, you know, it wasn't dating. It wasn't, I mean, you know, we all had jobs. We were interested in each other outside of AA. A lot of us had mutual friends. I mean, I was really lucky. I was really lucky. There were meetings everywhere. I could go to a meeting whenever I wanted. I actually thought it was really fun, you know. And so my first year was actually, you know, pretty easy. My second year, I went into a depression. That's also part of my story. And I, you know, that sponsor at that time turned out to not be the right sponsor for me as I was dealing with this other issue. And then around 5 years, that's when I first did the steps. It's different for everybody. And looking back, it wasn't a very thoughtful process. I think my sponsor, you know, gave me what she did, and it certainly was helpful. My number one resentment was my mother, and I can tell you it went away after that. And this is a woman that I didn't talk to for 10 years. I used to get a rash because I'd get so angry with her, like hives. I couldn't talk to her. And it went away after I did that fifth step. And, you know, for all of my fifth steps or fourth steps, there's only been like two or three people on them. You know, I didn't have a big book. And then when I had 10 years, so, you know, I get sober, my career gets back on track, I lose weight, you know, I meet my husband in AA, who is still one of my favorite people on the planet, but we both had 2 years of sobriety. I mean, we, you know, and we felt very safe with each other. We were best friends. We weren't in love with each other. And at 10 years, we moved to Phoenix. We started having issues in our marriage. And we thought, if we get out of D.C., it'll all be fixed. Because D.C. is just crazy. And I still believe it's just crazy. But so we moved to Phoenix and had room to kind of breathe. And we decided that it just wasn't working. And part of that decision for me was truly doing the steps with someone who said, we're meeting at Panera, we're starting at the page one, and we're going through. I had never done that before. I just hadn't. And it was the most amazing experience. And I can tell you that I went to a women's meeting, and that's where I met my sponsor. And she was just this totally laid-back woman that, you know, she was so clear. She didn't need to use big words. She was obviously smart. But she had, I don't know, 5 years more than me. And I just always really listened to her because I do believe find someone who has what you want. That is how I have always done sponsors, pick sponsors. And I just listened to her and I thought, she's really, really smart. And so we met and we decided, let's give it a shot. Well, she just laughed so hard because she is a liberal lesbian. Who has all kinds of ideas that are very, very far left. And I was a very conservative Republican that, you know, was married. And so she was like, God has such a funny sense of humor. I just, you know, I mean, and so we were, it was truly, she will always be probably right now I can say, and I have an amazing sponsor right now, but Marianne was the most meaningful sponsor I've ever had, and she taught me so much. And most of it was about being true to myself. Because by that time, I literally felt like I was playing a role in the movie of my life. I was being who my boss wanted me to be. I was being who my husband wanted me to be. I was being who, you know, my friends wanted me to be. I was being who my in-laws wanted me to be. You know, and I had lost myself completely. I mean, in every way, you know, I mean, the things I liked to do, the way I dressed, you know, and so all this to say that I will never forget when I did my third step in Arizona. Everybody hikes because it's so beautiful and there's so many great places to hike. And so we decided, let's go for a hike and do my third step. So we had our little backpacks with our big book and, you know, water, and we walked to the top of Squaw Peak, and we sat down, and we were sitting Indian style looking at each other, and she said, are you entirely ready to hand everything over to God as you understand him? And I said, I'm entirely ready to try really hard. Mm-hmm. And that is really all I could say. Mm-hmm. And I still have problems with that. But, you know, I was able to... you know, divorce is a really hard thing. And the other stories that I hear now, I think, wow, I had it pretty good. But at the time when I was in it, it was, you know, it was really, really hard. And so I really had to kind of figure out, like, who am I really? And doing the steps for me, it really helped me with that. Like getting back to, you know, I'm an alcoholic. This is what I need to do to stay sober. Now, I was not sober you know, drinking is a symptom of my alcoholism. I mean, and actually, I don't even think about drinking so much, but I can turn into a very mean person pretty quickly. And I know I have that in me. And even now, I can go there. And it's like venomous. And I know I have it. And, you know, so I really had to kind of like really look at myself, because I chose, it was not healthy for me to continue to be in this power struggle with my husband and our lawyers and writing all these checks and whatever. And my father said, just sign the papers and walk away. Come home. And that's what I did. I completely surrendered. And I walked away with not a lot, because he was pretty angry, because I kind of messed up his plan. And it's just so interesting, because we got divorced. I moved back to Washington. He called me a month later. And this actually says a lot about our friendship, because that was very real. And I don't know if this would have happened if I would have taken half his money. I doubt it would have happened, actually. And he'd probably still be pissed off. But he called me and he said, how are you doing? And I said, you know, it's really been very hard for me. And he said, it's been hard for me too. And I was wondering, can I fly you to Phoenix for a weekend so that we can talk about things? Because I'd like to make some amends. This is like a month and a half after we signed the divorce papers. And our process did not go on for 5 years. It went on for 8 months. And ever since then, we have had probably a better relationship than we ever had when we were married. And it's because of these rooms. And I feel really, really grateful for that. And he's even friends with my partner now. Like, they've met each other and they really like each other. And they could not be more different. And they ask each other's advice on things. I mean, it's really, and I came to realize how unique that is. You know, and we're like, wow, we're really healthy people, you know, because I know people that they can't even talk to their exes. They have to email, you know, and so I just feel very, very grateful. And all that stuff, you know, going through, and it has been, there have been really, really, really dark moments in my life with mental illness that was not properly diagnosed and I didn't understand. With, you know, family tragedies, with a mother that was very challenging, with the death of my father, which is probably the hardest thing that's ever happened to me in my life, with, you know, finding someone that was so incredibly perfect for me, but being really, really scared of that. Because I always played it safe. I did. I knew my husband would never cheat on me. I knew he'd never lie to me. And I knew he would, you know, we were in the same field. And, you know, I would always feel important because he was, in my opinion, a very important person that hung out with other important people. And we would be doing the things that I thought would make me feel important. And like I said, I mean, I really did become an actress in the story of my life. And I played a role. And, you know, but going through all those different things, and I never had children, but I did have a unbelievable Brittany Spaniel who we trained and bought before she was born. And I know it sounds really silly to parents, but leaving my dog, I cried. She was like my child. So that may sound silly to some people, but that was very hard for me. And, you know, what I can say is I really want to kind of close this conversation that I'm having with you and myself with a message of hope, because every day is a new day. And for me, you know, being a sober woman means that I can have a conversation in a challenging situation that doesn't have to erupt like a volcano. Or at least if it does, it can come back down pretty quickly. I know how to act. Sometimes I don't act that way, but I know what's right. And And I know that, you know, I know what my triggers are. I know when I'm going fear, I know what can happen, and it's not pretty. I know that it's better to pause and maybe not send that email. I know better. When I was drinking, I didn't know better. At least I forgot if I did know better. I mean, I was reckless with other people, and I got away with a lot. And, you know, I'm not proud of that, actually. If I would have gotten in trouble a little earlier, I probably would have got sober a little earlier, you know. But, again, everybody's on their own path, right? So, you know, I just feel like I look at my life today and, you know, David and I have talked about this before, like, oh, my gosh, we made it. Now we've got the second half of our lives. How's that going to look? And that is, like, the most exciting thing to think about for me. Like, I've had all these different experiences. Pretty much anything that can happen to a person, except for having, like, a limb amputated, has happened to me. And I haven't lost a child. But I've lost siblings, you know? And I've made it. I've made it through. And it hasn't been because I'm so great. It's been because I always had people that I could turn to. And that's mostly because of these rooms. I mean, most of my adult life, I've been in AA. I wasn't an adult until I was, you know, 29. I was a late bloomer. I was a spoiled, rotten kid that had a title and nice suits. But I was a child. And, you know, so all the different things that have happened, you know, all the different lessons that I learned, and I really believe in learning something new every day and doing something that scares you every day. And I just think about, like, how lucky I am to have the fellowship of AA. And, you know, a lot of people can't say that they have a list of, you know, five people that they could call at 4 a.m. if they were in trouble. I've got a list of about 15 that I would feel comfortable calling. And I had never really asked for help until I moved back to Washington after my divorce. I thought that was weak. You know, and that was like at, what, 12 years of sobriety? I thought it was weak. I thought if someone else asked for help, I'm happy to help them. And I actually have helped a lot of people in whatever way I could. But that was not really something that I did. I had to learn that. And I had to do, like, a complete surrender. Complete surrender. And, you know, I lost everything. And I lived with a friend. And because I went into, you know, a depression after that, I couldn't even think right. And what I know is that if you just keep doing the next right thing, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it feels like you're lifting 50 pounds of bricks, you know, just to get out of bed. At least that's how I felt. If you just keep doing the next right thing, God really does have a plan. And I've really just started to realize that in the past year and a half. And if I look back over my life and I reflect and I think of the people that are in my life now and what my relationships look like now, it really is like the most perfect, you know, it all fits together. And I don't know what's going to happen, right? But I do trust that there has been, you know, a higher power involved and that it has all worked out. And if I wouldn't have been in those really ugly spots, I would not appreciate what I have half as much. I mean, I have so much gratitude today. We have had a really tough year with, you know, my father dying, and then I work for myself, and anybody who does that knows that you get a contract, then it ends, and you got to look for the next contract. And we had a bunch of stops and starts, and so financial insecurity crept in. You know, a little bit, but, you know, I do have, you know, an amazing family and an amazing partner and all that stuff. And it just, it all worked out. And right when we were getting really, really worried, like, the job from, I never would have thought I would have gotten the job that I got 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, fell out of the sky. It was more perfect than anything I would have ever looked at. And, you know, our feeling the whole time was, don't take something just to take something. Like, you know, and I feel glad that I had a person in my life that said that. I don't want you to settle. Like, we will make this work. I don't want you to settle. I believe in you. I want you to get back to where you want to be. And I'm grateful for that. And so, you know, again, I just think that anything can happen. And, you know, I have good days and bad days, more good days than bad days. But I think it's because of the people I surround myself with. You know, I can tell in my body when something's not right, and I listen to that now. I try to, you know, be as healthy as I can. We've had a lot of big changes, I started to say. You know, my 17-year-old sister, who was adopted from Liberia when I was 30, has come to live with us. She has spent the past three summers with us, and we love her, and she's made a choice to live with us. And, you know, we have been raised by the same mother, so I completely understand why that would be a healthier thing for her right now, because she's got to look at colleges and stuff, and she doesn't have time to be locked in a room for 3 weeks because she doesn't want to say, "You're right, Mom." You know, and I used to coach her, like, "You're not going to win. You're never going to win." Like, you're the kid. She's the mom. Doesn't matter if you're right. Let it go. You know, and I was not like that. I'd be like, "I'm sorry," because I was a manipulator, you know, but this one digs her heels in. And, you know, so it's just so cute. But I've never been a mother. And I'm not her mother. And I think that's probably why our relationship is different. But I've never been responsible for anyone other than myself, even when I was married. But we didn't even have shared bank accounts. I mean, we were partners. And he took care of these things, and I took care of these things, and it worked. So that's been wonderful, but also scary for me. Like, I want to make sure that I'm setting the right example and doing the right thing. And, you know, she's not my friend, you know. And she's very mature. I mean, she was adopted from a Liberian refugee camp when she was 5. The great thing about my mom is that she wants us to be exposed to everything. I grew up that way, too. I've been to a lot of different countries. And she has, too. And, you know, so really making sure that I have healthy boundaries with her, and I'm giving her what she needs and making sure that she has the opportunities that she needs to be successful. You know, and I also have, for all intents and purposes, 2 stepchildren, which has been challenging for me. And, you know, I feel grateful that I have the luxury of being able to see a therapist about that and have a sponsor that has been through that. And 'cause it's really tough. It's really tough, especially when no one's talking to each other. And I have my own sets of ideas about how things should be, which isn't fair, and it's probably inappropriate. And keeping that in is really hard for me. And so we're working on all those things. But the point, again, is that I have the tools. I have, you know, I'm fortunate to have, you know, a partner that is also in these rooms. And we can talk things out. We were saying the other night, like, we've never been in a fight for longer than 24 hours. And we don't fight. We just disagree because we're really different, you know. And that is because of the steps and the rooms and the examples that we have. And, you know, so I feel really grateful for that. So, you know, again, the message that I hope that I give you all tonight, or even one person, is hope. And, you know, for me, it's like, you never know what someone's really been through, right? I mean, someone can look a certain way, but they might just be playing a role in the story of their life. It happens all the time. It happened to me. So I feel really, again, just filled with gratitude that I have been able to, you know, at least start to be myself and to be able to say, I don't know. That was another thing. I never would say, I don't know. I'm an expert. I go in and, like, train people and coach people and whatever. So it's not my job to say, I don't know. But now I've realized that, like, I don't know anything. I really don't. And it's actually made me more valuable to my clients. Wow, right? And a better mentor to people that, you know, are working with me. So, you know, humility. These are things that I have learned in the past 4 years. Humility, gratitude, and being true to myself. And when I have all those things, there's a ton of hope in my world. And I appreciate you inviting me, and thank you for letting me share.